Good morning, current affairs listeners. I am Aisling McRae, Podmaster General. I am here today with a very special guest. We have Libby Watson. She is a journalist and former staff writer for The New Republic. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Vice, New York Magazine, amongst many others. And now she is launching a Substack newsletter called Sick Note, a newsletter about America's broken healthcare system. Hello, Libby.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, we're having a Brits-only podcast today. We're only going to be talking about smack bomb P. Wet. We're going to be pronouncing Shear correctly. Worcestershire, Hertfordshire.
Roots. Yeah.
We're going to be pronouncing all the shears and we're going to be doing them correctly.
All right, putting the extra I in aluminium.
Right, so you've written about a lot of political topics throughout the years, but even before this newsletter, one of the topics you've written on most frequently is healthcare. So I just thought I'd start by asking, what kind of drew you to that topic?
I mean, to be honest, a lot of it was probably to do with Bernie Sanders, sort of making it something that was, you know, I think obviously more prominent in the discourse, but as well, just the sort of single payer movement in general. I grew up as kind of a, I was kind of a lib. You know, when I first moved to America, I was like very much of that generation that, you know, I was 18 when Obama got elected, and I like kind of believed in all of that stuff. You know, I was a bit of a West Wing idiot, and you know, healthcare was like the, you know, I feel like the, I remember when, you know, the public option was kind of kiboshed in the first, you know, in early on in the ACA fight. And that, I feel like, was the first moment where I was really like, damn, like I'm an idiot. I should not have believed all this stuff. And I think, you know, when Bernie ran in 2016 and, you know, beyond then, for me, it was like, oh, we actually can talk about single payer. Like, we can talk about the prospect of having, you know, a good healthcare system. But, you know, I mean, I was writing about politics for Splinter at the time, and, you know, it just sort of naturally gravitated towards writing about healthcare, in part because, obviously, being British, I think having that experience of a proper healthcare system can really radicalize you pretty quickly. Like, the first time you have to learn what a deductible is and things like that, moving here. And also, you know, I'm from kind of a medical family. My stepdad's a doctor, and my mum, I actually interviewed her for Splinter once about how, you know, when I was growing up, she was an activist in our hometown of Banbury. Terrible, terrible place. Really just one of the most boring towns in Britain. But she was active in trying to keep our local hospital open, because the Tories and then New Labour and then the Tories again were constantly trying to close it, you know, getting rid of the maternity ward and well, not the maternity ward, but the obstetrics consultants. So you can have, now you can have your baby at Banbury, but if anything goes wrong, then they have to put you in an ambulance and send you to Oxford.
Yeah, we have a similar thing, like where I grew up, like there's no maternity ward, like at the local hospital, you have to go sort of 5 miles down.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, it's frustrating. I wrote about this, I did a whole series about this for Splinter. You know, obviously the NHS being just so much better, light years ahead of the American healthcare system, you know, particularly in terms of equity and quote unquote access. But also having grown up with an NHS family, and also, you know, my mum being so involved in, you know, this activism to keep the hospital open, it's kind of like, you know, a reminder that obviously the NHS is not perfect, and also is, you know, subject to the same kinds of forces of privatization and everything that have made American healthcare so bad. You know, it's not immune to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering, yes, because you are English, as we have noted. Mm-hmm. And so you've kind of gone from, it's not just, the NHS is not just a universal healthcare system, but in a weird way, it's like the most socialized healthcare system, in that like a lot of most stable countries have a universal healthcare system, but often they'll be insurance based, or they have a lot more of a public-private mix, right. Whereas the NHS, at least nominally, you know, it's all taxpayer paid for and mostly free at the point of service. And so it's kind of, in a way, the most extreme form of universal healthcare, which seems like a strange way to say it, but that's obviously a very big jump from the British system to the American system. So yeah, I was wondering if what your personal experiences are of the NHS versus the US system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm a chronic migraine sufferer, and that's something I wrote about for Splinter as well. And so I definitely noticed, you know, comparing my experience, you know, getting treatment for that on the NHS versus when I came here. I mean, you know, getting migraines is like, it really sucks. And I'm lucky that mine are better than they used to be, and also better than some people. Some people have a migraine every day or whatever. And it's one of these conditions where it is like definitely a hassle and difficult to get care for. And it's certainly something where, you know, if you live in a rural or even just outside a major city at all, it's going to be harder to find a neurologist who will treat you. And the drugs are expensive and stuff, but it's the sort of difficulty of treating it is not as high as certain other conditions. So it is like a chronic thing that takes a lot of time and energy and money to manage, but it's not kind of as bad as it could be, especially for me. So I have kind of had to dip my toe in like the experience of, you know, managing a chronic condition in the US. And, you know, it's something that I have to get a lot of care for, and it's something I have to think about. I mean, leaving my full-time job at the New Republic to start this meant that I was abandoning my very cushy union-provided insurance plan, which is something I had to think about really hard because I loved that. It was great. It was really cheap and, you know, really good, covered a lot of stuff. And so, but Substack is like subsidizing the cost of me getting insurance on the Affordable Care Act exchange. So I got to do that for the first time. And, you know, I had to think really hard about which plan I would pick because I have to get these drugs every month. They're expensive. And there's really no, you know, this is something I wrote about in one of my sort of teaser posts for Sick Note. You know, there's really no way for me to even find out whether my stuff will be covered before I sign up. I can look at the formulary for each plan and, you know, find out if it's covered. And if it's not, I can apply for an exception. And I have really no way of knowing whether that exception will be approved. It's very arbitrary.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about healthcare once for Current Affairs a while back. And this is one of the things, one of the rhetorical sleight of hands that really frustrates me in American healthcare. You know, you get all these like private healthcare lobbying groups. They're all called things like Americans for Choice for Access to Care for America.
Absolutely.
It's this rhetoric of choice in healthcare when what you actually have is not a choice of what people actually want is a choice of providers and of treatment, right? But you don't get that. You get a choice of plans. And a plan is not the same thing as actually getting healthcare. It's just a big list of things that you might be able to get or might not. That is something that I've always found a little bit frustrating is the elision of the idea of choice with these incredibly baroque and unclear plans.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's like, you make a very good point, which is that most people, I don't think really most people care a lot about having a choice of insurance provider. I don't think anyone is particularly wedded to Cigna versus Blue Cross Blue Shield or whatever. They want to be able to choose the plan that will cover the most for the least money, you know, which kind of tells us like, well, maybe if there was just one plan that covered everything and, you know, didn't cost people different amounts, it didn't, you know, cost people, you know, half their paycheck, that's what they would want. But the thing that people really do want is a choice of their doctor, because it takes a long time, you know, sometimes to find a doctor that you like. I know that it's really important to me to be able to keep seeing my neurologist because she knows all my history and stuff. And that's one of the things that you absolutely cannot have under this system, because even if you pick an insurance plan that is accepted by your doctor now, they might drop out of the network because, you know, of a dispute over how much they'll, you know, the insurance company will pay for services or whatever. And so even if you think you have that choice and you've made the right choice now, it might turn out to be completely wrong. And also, you know, if the doctor that you like is not in network in the first place, then there's nothing you can do about that. And which is especially insulting given that, you know, most people don't have a choice of providers or whatever. You're completely right that the idea of choice, I think I said in my newsletter about the ACA that, you know, at the end of the experience of buying care on the exchange, I felt like I'd been offered the choice to be like shot or stabbed, and then also felt stupid for not knowing whether or not I was making the right decision.
I'm also curious what impressions Americans have of the NHS and how you sort of respond to it or counter it. Because the impression I get in the UK is that the idea of what the NHS is and what it does is pretty distorted. Like, you get those cases like Charlie Gard, like the terminally ill child who was cared for at a Great Ormond Street in London, which is one of the best children's hospitals in the world. He sadly was terminally ill, and the parents were told, you know, he's going to pass away and there's nothing we can do about that. And this became a big cause célèbre in the US, people like Ted Cruz and a lot of conservatives basically saying that this was, you know, death panels and this was Britain killing a child because it cost too much. And I was wondering, like, how widespread is that? Is that just a conservative thing or is that more widespread? And how do you sort of respond to that, I guess?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I've got a couple good stories I can tell about that. First, the one that comes to mind. So I did a year of my undergrad at UCLA, and that was in... I'm going to reveal how old I am now. That was 2010, 2011.
Yeah. I mean, you already said you were 18 when Obama was elected. So you've
That's true. I've really just, you know, I am just like putting it all on the table. I am really, really old. Yeah. So I did a year of undergrad at UCLA, and it was around the time that the Tea Party, you know, was rocking. You know, I like canvassed for the Democrats in the 2010 midterms and stuff. And it was funny because, like, California was actually kind of a bright spot that year for the Democrats. And so it didn't feel quite as disastrous for us as it was for the rest of the country. But yeah, 2010, really bad time. Anyway, there was an event at UCLA, you know, it was like a panel about the Tea Party, you know, kind of like, you know, what is this thing? How do we analyze this political phenomenon? And there were three panelists. There was someone who was doing their PhD on the Tea Party. There was Michael Dukakis, who lectured at UCLA like one quarter out of the year. When it was cold in Boston, he would come to UCLA and teach there. And then he would go back for the rest of the year, which is just such a baller move. And then the last panelist was this like local Tea Party activist from Orange County or something, which is like, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, pretty insane place. You know, this guy started talking about healthcare because obviously, you know, this was like not long after the passage of the ACA, and the Tea Party guy started spouting off about how, oh, you know, in the UK, you know, if you get cancer, they'll throw you out on the street. And I, you know, during the question period, I kind of stood up and I was like, hello, I'm British. Just so you know, that's not really true. I don't really know what that means, that if you get cancer, they throw you out on the street. Like, never heard of that. Stepdad's a doctor. I don't know that he's ever thrown anyone on the street. And, one of the things he brought up was the kind of the death panels, you know, idea or whatever. And so my question was like, isn't it kind of a death panel when your insurance company decides that they won't cover for, you know, something that you need, or if you can't afford insurance at all, you're going to be waiting for, you know, the rest of your entire life? And, you know, as a, you know, like little 20-year-old, I felt so great that Michael Dukakis was like, that's a good question. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. but no, I absolutely, you know, even at UCLA, like other students, I remember one time in class, someone made some joke about Britain, you know, I think it was like a Revolutionary War history class. And someone made some joke about how, oh, we beat the Brits or whatever. And I was like, yeah, well, we've got free healthcare.
So. Yeah, this is also not on topic, but I love how Americans like think we're really mad about the Revolutionary War still.
I know. They talk about it like, you know, every 4th of July party I went to for the first like 5 years after I moved here, they were like, oh, is this a bit of a sore subject for you? I was like, no, dude, we don't give a shit. Like,
we literally had a war called the Hundred Years' War, and we don't even cover it because we've been in so many wars.
I never learned anything about that at school. Absolutely nothing. But, you know, the poor quality of British history education is definitely a topic for.
Oh yeah, that's a whole other thing. But I think
Ireland. What's Ireland?
Who knows?
Never learned about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so you know, he was like, oh, you know, I said, oh, well, you know, we have free healthcare, and then he said, oh yeah, but don't you guys have to go to the doctor in groups? And I was like, first of all, I don't really know how that would work. Like, you're all sitting in the
waiting room. You have to find, like, if you have a migraine, you have to find like, six other people who have a migraine, and then you
before
all
you're allowed to go. Yeah. Right? Yeah, I thought maybe like the doctor comes out and is like, "All right, who's got herpes?" And then you know, all the herpes people shuffle off or whatever. So yeah, absolutely, the misconception is like. There's two things for me. One is these like weird conservative misconceptions about how it works. And also the other thing I hear a lot is like, yeah, but don't you guys pay a lot more tax? I mean, yeah, we do pay a little bit more tax, but we also don't pay health insurance premiums. So it really adds up to, I mean, if you include health insurance, there's plenty of studies showing that, you know, if you include health insurance premiums as a tax, which is really what they are because it's paying for something that you need to stay alive, then Americans pay just as much, you know, if not more than people in the rest of the world.
I think that's a big part of like the reason that people might be suspicious of it is people kind of assume that prices would stay the same, when a big part of the reason why US healthcare is so expensive is because of these incentives to get for the prices to keep getting higher and higher. So actually, if you look at like what the NHS spends on a pacemaker versus what an American spends on a pacemaker, is actually much less. So you don't even necessarily spend that much more.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, going back to, you know, my personal experience, like one of the first sort of real appointments with a doctor I had in the US was, you know, I was still on my sort of student health insurance plan from when I was a grad student in DC. And I went to a neurologist to talk about migraines because my migraines were kind of going through a worse period. And I had seen a neurologist when I was about 19 back in the UK on the NHS. And I wanted to, you know, go again to kind of talk about treatment options, because there are, at the time, there were not that many very good preventive drugs for migraines, and they all had a lot of side effects and stuff. So I tried some and wanted to go back and talk about others. And so I saw this neurologist at GW in DC. It's a very good hospital. And I spoke to her assistant, you know, like, I think it was a medical resident, for about 45 minutes, and gave them all of my history and talked about the various things that I'd taken. You know, I'd tried about 4 different classes of migraine drug at that point, and talked to her for, you know, 45 minutes. And then the actual neurologist came in for 5 minutes, immediately got something from my history wrong, and sort of wouldn't listen when I tried to correct her. And then, you know, she did the kind of standard neurological function tests, you know, where they like make you touch your finger to your nose and stuff like that. And obviously it was all fine. And then she said, I'm going to order you an MRI just in case, to see if, you know, if there's any kind of, you know, basically if my migraines have been caused by a brain tumor or something. And, you know, I was thinking like, well, you know, if it was, I've been having migraines since I was like 9. So if it was a brain tumor, I think I'd be dead by now. And comparing also that exact experience to when I saw the neurologist on the NHS when I was 19, she specifically said to me, I could order an MRI if you want, but I don't think it's necessary because it's clearly not a neurological, you know, it's not a brain tumor, so you don't need one, you know? And you could say like, well, maybe that's bad because the incentive is for the NHS to spend less and to not provide tests and stuff. But at the end of the day, I got this fucking MRI and GW, it cost me $300 that I didn't have because I was a student, and the result was obviously clear because I obviously didn't have a brain tumor. You know, so the incentives are completely different.
I feel like Americans get loads of MRIs.
They love getting MRIs.
Yeah. It's their favorite thing.
No, I've had multiple experiences at the doctor where, you know, I have received tests that I was not sure that I needed. And, you know, there are much worse examples of this. Like, obviously, you know, $300 for an MRI is a lot, but you know, it is a known and documented problem that the American medical system sort of tends towards over-provision of healthcare for people with private insurance that will pay for it, and under-provision of healthcare for people who are uninsured or have Medicaid, or, you know, plans that don't want to pay for it, basically. And it's just this completely ridiculous situation where the country is spending more per capita on healthcare than anywhere else for worse outcomes, and yet it's all based on this, you know, overprovision of care in a just a completely inequitable way. And it's just sort of obvious that you need a kind of systemic overhaul to change that. You know, when the problem is throughout the whole system, you need to change the whole system, you know?
Mm. And I think it's tricky because there are issues with, for example, the NHS in terms of underfunding of certain, like, especially kind of mid-range, you know, not emergency and not minor, but sort of things like, you know, knee replacements and hip replacements, chronic illnesses, mental health care. I mean, mental health care everywhere, I think, is you know, chronically underfunded. And so it's easy for people to look at that and say, oh, well, then that automatically means that having universal health care means a lower standard of care. But it's the case that, I mean, the NHS could probably be funded a lot more and still be less expensive. Like, if you wanted to have a Medicare for all situation that did cover things better than the NHS did, you probably could.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
not. Yeah,
I mean, this is something that I've written about before, both specifically the NHS angle, and also, you know, I think a lot of the time when we talk about Medicare for All, we talk about, you know, one of the arguments that's put forward is like, well, it would cost a lot less because, you know, one of the big criticisms of Medicare for All is, oh, it would cost too much. And so you naturally have to counter that and explain why that's incorrect and how we actually do spend more than anywhere else. It's just mostly done through private spending rather than the government. You know, that's a really important point to make. But actually, you know, I wrote a piece for the New Republic about this, about how you know, spending less on healthcare overall is not in itself a good goal. Like, healthcare is one of the best things that a society can spend money on. It's, you know, having more time with dying relatives. It's, you know, the extension of life and health and happiness. That's a great thing for us to spend money on. So, you know, the idea that, oh, with Medicare for All, then we could spend as little as Britain or whatever. I don't want to spend as little as Britain. I want to spend more than Britain. I want Britain to spend more than Britain currently does on healthcare. You know, I absolutely have, you know, personal experiences with the NHS, like, being inadequate. You know, if I moved home, for example, I still wouldn't be able to get Aimovig, which is this monthly preventative migraine drug that I take, because the National Institute for, they renamed it. It used to be for clinical excellence. I can't remember what it is now, but the NICE, the body that, the body that determines basically what drugs they'll pay for, the death panel. You know, they decided that the evidence for Aimovig wasn't strong enough to justify the expense. It's like $600 a month or something per injection. It's $600, which is a lot. And it's frustrating because it's like, well, if I moved home, I wouldn't be able to get this drug that I need on the NHS. And that's really bad. And I think they made the wrong decision there. And I think part of the reason they made that wrong decision is its cost, which is frustrating. You can actually, I'm pretty sure you can get it on NHS Scotland because they just get everything. Just everything is better up there, so maybe I'll have to move to Edinburgh or whatever. But, you know, it sucks on a systemic level when the NHS makes decisions like that. But in the US, those decisions are being made all the time by private insurance companies. But, you know, hundreds of different plans, you know, thousands of different plans are making decisions every day, but, you know, to cover or not cover drugs, to issue exceptions or not for drugs, and to set costs at levels that are, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, you know, are making these decisions to set the price of drugs at unaffordable levels and so on. And it's just much less accountable because it's happening in private hands. You know, at least when the NHS makes a bad decision, you can go to your MP and say, hey, can you do something about the NHS? Now, it's a different issue that they, you know, obviously suck and can't do anything about that, and the democracy doesn't work and all of those minor issues. But
it's a broken country and it's
all of that stuff. But, you know, theoretically, I don't see, there's this weird sort of Reaganite idea that, you know, private companies will be better or more responsive to, you know, the market and people's needs or whatever. But it just seems completely incorrect to me, the idea that, you know, Aetna or Blue Cross Blue Shield is going to be more accountable to, you know, the needs of consumers / patients / you know, living human beings than, you know, a nationalized, you know, health insurance system that is done through the government. You know, the government is traditionally the way that we have expressed our, you know, democratic desires. So I don't know why anyone would think that, you know, Aetna would be any better at that.
Yeah, and I mean, there are systems, like, I think in France, like, the system is a little bit more expensive, but it has more scope for things, like, it provides often, like, more experimental treatments that you can try, or a wider range of things. And that's a question that, you know, the balance of how much to provide versus cost is, you know, a question you can ask and have debates on, but it's not a question of having a poorly funded universal system or a completely inaccessible private system. You can do other things.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's sort of frustrating because a lot of the time people who support the public option as opposed to Medicare for All will point to, you know, countries like Germany or the Netherlands or whatever and say, well, they have, you know, private insurance too. And it's not even close to comparable to the kind of private insurance that exists in the US.
I can actually speak to that because I lived in the Netherlands. I had private insurance because that's the system that it is, but it is capped and it is heavily regulated. So I looked at different insurance plans when I got there. I was a little bit scared because the only idea I had for insurance systems was like the American system. So I thought, I'm going to be spending days like comparing all these plans, and I might have to, like, something goes wrong, I might have to, like, if I start having a heart attack, I might try and stumble onto the Eurostar so I can get back home. But it was there were like five companies, I don't know. The plans were all very similar, covered most stuff. They're definitely not perfect systems. Like, I think the Netherlands does have some, you know, some gaps and stuff. And they all cost about the same, which for me as a student was 100 euros a month, $100 a month. So, right. Yeah, not the same thing.
Yeah, it's very frustrating because, like, you know, the idea that we can't point to other systems and say, look, these obviously work better, you know, even if they're not perfect. And, you know, the existence of things like people like my mum, for example, having to advocate for keeping hospitals open and stuff in the UK is not evidence that it's not a good system. It's evidence that you can never stop fighting for, you know, health justice, that the fight doesn't stop. You know, if we got Medicare for All tomorrow, there would still be so much that would need to be done to ensure, you know, an adequate, fair healthcare system. But to me, it really says more about America, about the extremely large gap that needs to be made up, than it does about Britain. You know, if Britain's NHS can be as, you know, kind of shitty as it is at times and still be so much better than the American system, I think says more about the American system than it does about the NHS.
Yeah. So you've started this newsletter called Sick Note, which I believe is coming out January 5th. But people can subscribe now, can't they?
Yeah. I've done a few kind of teaser posts over December. You know, I did a thing where I had people send me, you know, details about what they were paying for health insurance on the exchange, which was eye-opening and depressing. And, you know, I've done one of the kind of stories that I'm going to be doing, you know, going forward, an interview with a lady in Georgia who had a really rough time with COVID. She was hospitalized with COVID-19. And then because of that, she missed income because she didn't have any paid sick leave, and, you know, talked to her about the impact that had on her life. She was also evicted earlier this year. And so, you know, those are the kind of stories that I'm going to be telling going forward, starting in January. But yeah, absolutely. If people want to subscribe before the launch, they can. I'm very grateful for it. And that's, you know, what makes the whole thing possible. But starting in January, it'll be regular weekly interviews with people about the healthcare system, which is vague on purpose, because I want to kind of take a very broad look at what healthcare is, not just, you know, insurance and doctor's bills and stuff, although a lot of that stuff too, but, you know, the impact that poverty has on health, as well as, you know, the actual health care system or non-system in America. And then also other posts, you know, roundups of healthcare news and things like that.
Okay, so it's going to be kind of a mix, because I've subscribed already, and what I've seen so far is it's more the personal stories, but it's going to be more of a mix of, like, I think those personal stories are really important because they show the human side, the human cost of this whole thing.
Right.
But is there going to be more of the, like, the analytical stuff or keeping up with the healthcare policy stuff, or is it more just on the personal side?
So my plan is weekly, or, you know, sometimes more interviews with you know, personal stories, like you say, and not just personal stories. You know, I don't want to just talk to patients. I want to talk to doctors. You know, if there are doctors and nurses out there, then get at me. I want to talk to, you know, hospital administrators and, you know, nurses aides and all kinds of different healthcare workers and, you know, other kinds of workers. But also on Fridays, I'm going to send out roundups of healthcare news with a little bit of my commentary and stuff. And I also want to hear from, you know, I'm going to send out an email later this week asking people to just let me know what they want to see. You know, I want this. One of the advantages of Substack is that, you know, obviously it's all dependent on my audience, my readers. You know, I want to create a real little community and get as much feedback from readers as I can. You know, I've got everyone's email address is the thing about having an email-based newsletter. So, you know, I want people to email me and tell me what they want to see. You know, I have some ideas for the future, but yeah, I really want to make it as interactive as I can. But starting out, it'll be weekly interviews and stories, and then also weekly roundups of the news. And, you know, obviously, I want to do as much as I can while also maintaining my sanity and free time. I think it takes a little bit more time to do justice to these kinds of stories, you know, where I'm actually interviewing people each week. So maybe publishing a little less frequently than some other Substacks, but the trade-off for that is more reported detail rather than, you know, just firing off takes.
Yeah, and being able to have that, I guess, freedom of what to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds great. I just want to, in our kind of last little bit of time, kind of ask a little bit about what you think the kind of future of universal healthcare is now that we have our brand new exciting president. You live in DC, is that correct? Yeah, so presumably you are around sort of government policy people. You overhear people in the restaurants talking about...
Oh God, yes.
I've been to DC once, and my experience was going into a pizza restaurant that had a pizza to celebrate women in politics.
Oh my god. Is that Pizzeria Paradiso?
It might have been, yeah. I think it was kind of near DuPont Circle-ish.
Yeah, that's them. Yeah. They used to go in for that kind of stuff. Yeah. Oh no, you can't fucking move for bars that are doing like, oh, the Pete Buttigieg drink or whatever, you know. And every time there was like a debate or even like hearings, like the James Comey like being hauled in front of Congress or whatever, then you've got, you know, all these awful bars doing drink specials for it. It's just a horrible place. Bad place.
Yeah. So do you get the impression that among people who are in those political circles, those policy circles, that the attitude towards universal healthcare is changing at all? Do you get the impression that there might be some movement there? Or is it a bit more of a, do you have a bit more of a cynical take?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest and say that, you know, I don't have a lot of friends here. And so I'm not really even less well tuned in than I used to be into, you know, the kind of like insider stuff. And especially since COVID, I'm not even overhearing people at bars and restaurants anymore, which is a real, real sadness. You know, not running into people at parties, you know, the half an hour that I would spend at parties a year, I'm missing out on that. Which is, you know, good in one sense that I'm not having to sort of smile and nod through a conversation with some kind of awful lobbyist or whatever. But so, you know, I can't really, you know, pretend that I'm all that tuned in, even though I do live here. But I will say that, you know, I think even if you just look at the tone of, so there's this group called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which is like one of my biggest enemies.
Partnership for Choice for Freedom for America. Yes, for
exactly.
Choice,
yeah.
Access.
No, just the worst name. It's so long. I really hate them. And, you know, I did a post at Splinter about how, you know, they used to do this thing where they would send out emails, like press releases, like highlighting what people are saying about how single payer is bad. And they would highlight all of these like op-eds from, you know, random small newspapers across the country. And when you look into the people that were writing them, the people that were writing them were like healthcare lobbyists, like, you know, former members of Congress or like former staffers or whatever. It's not exactly astroturfing. I think it's called grass tops, where you kind of, it's not grassroots, but you kind of like, you know, gin up this idea that, you know, there's this groundswell of support out there that just doesn't exist. And you do that by contacting, you know, like local elites and so on to make it seem like everyone in the country is talking about how dangerous single payer would be, when actually it's just the people in your Rolodex.
I love when you get those, sometimes you'll get a story that's like, local business owner, you know, Jenny Jones, and then you Google Jenny Jones and they're working for like a think tank and living in like a $4 million McMansion.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is like, there's no rules about how you identify people who write op-eds. So you can just say a homeowner in Montana or whatever. And it turns out that, you know, they own that home because their job was selling insurance or something. Anyway, if you just look at the tone of their tweets now, I find their Twitter account really funny, because like there are so many jobs in DC that are just like fake, basically. And, you know, people get paid like low six figures, or, you know, let's say like $90,000 a year for their job to be like running the Twitter accounts of like 5 to 7, like fake, you know, fake grassroots astroturfed organizations that are just front groups for bigger lobbying firms, like, you know, like Pharma or the American Petroleum Institute or whatever. And, you know, their jobs is just like making it seem as if these are kind of real people doing real things. And if you just look at their Twitter account, it's depressing, because like they no longer really even have to fight single payer. Like there is simply no prospect of single payer happening in the next couple years. You know, Joe Biden ran on, you know, partially on criticizing single payer, on lying about single payer, frankly. You know, he told all kinds of lies, you know, in mid-2019, he was saying all kinds of just like completely false stuff about single payer. And, you know, it depends on what happens in Georgia, of course. You know, if the Democrats win both seats in Georgia, then maybe things are back on in terms of the public option. But without a Democratic Senate, then I truly can't imagine what kind of healthcare reform could be possible. I mean, they just got the surprise billing fix in, you know, in this big tranche of bills that were just passed. But even that is not great. It's not ideal. It's better for consumers, but still not good. And, you know, and that is something, like the surprise billing issue is something that is just like, no one thinks it's good. Like nobody except for people who make money off it think it's good for patients to receive these huge surprise bills, because the surgeon that operated them on them when they were unconscious is out of network. You know, like no one thinks that is good. Even Republicans admit that surprise billing is an issue. And it still took 2 years and all of these different compromises and all of this time and effort to come to a bill that is frankly not even that good. So I don't feel good about the prospect of any kind of real healthcare reform in the next couple of years. You know, there are things that Joe Biden could do unilaterally. He could maybe reverse some of the terrible decisions that Trump has made in terms of, like, you know, things like deregulating these like short-term junk insurance plans and things like that. There are stuff like that, but I don't think we should really like hold our breaths for any kind of like significant public option being passed in the next couple of years, let alone single payer. You know, it's at least the next 2 to 4 years. We're going to have to hunker down for a bit. Wait.
Be very careful when crossing the street. And
seriously. Yeah, absolutely. Look both ways. I'm uninsured for this month until, you know, what have we got? Like 4 more days where I'm uninsured. So I've been absolutely just like going outside less, basically, even less than during, you know, pandemic rules. You know what? Like, I don't need to go to the park today. I'll be all right, actually.
Yeah. Do you think that COVID-19 has had any impact on how people are viewing healthcare or how things are moving?
You know, it's an interesting question because, like, if you'd asked me that in March or April, I might have said yes. And then it's sort of, you know, I think things kind of changed after the election. I think, you know, all this time, in the run-up to the election, there were all these stories about how, like, Joe Biden is actually really, really understands how serious the pandemic is. And, you know, it's really changed his view of what's possible and necessary. And, you know, he's planning an FDR-sized presidency or whatever. And that always just drove me insane because I'm like, bro, no, he isn't. Like, come on. Like, I'm not an idiot. But I think that dissipated even more when, you know, unexpectedly Democrats did not win the Senate. And, you know, obviously it remains to be seen with Georgia and stuff. Something could happen there. But I think this kind of interim period where we don't know what the makeup of the Senate is going to be, and, you know, assuming that things are going to be as bad in Georgia as they were, you know, in the results of the general election, I feel like it's sort of given Joe Biden leeway to be the kind of guy he really is, which is the guy who believes that Republicans will have an epiphany and come to him. And it's just going to be this like slow realization, if there is one, that is complete nonsense. Like, Mitch McConnell is not going to have a fucking epiphany. Are you insane? But, you know, the existence of Mitch McConnell there just to block everything has kind of like, it changes everything, you know? And it does, you know, even if, I don't know, like Kamala Harris or Pete Buttigieg or, you know, like Dick Durbin or whatever had realized in the aftermath of COVID, like, oh, it would be really great if we had a healthcare system. You know, we could sure use a healthcare system right now. I frankly don't think that realization matters, because the fact on the ground is that Mitch McConnell is there smirking and blocking anything of any value. And the notion of like sneaking some kind of healthcare reform past him, I don't know. It's just the timing of this, everything that happened this year was just truly awful. You know, like when you think about the timing of the primaries versus COVID happening, just like, you know, the results in November, just these Senate seats and so on. It's just like things did not work out well. It was not good. I hate to say it, but I feel like we kind of missed our chance a little bit. And I don't know, you know, I can't really say that I have any hope that, like, I mean, I think one of the things you have to come to terms with living in America is like the obviousness of a problem doesn't translate into energy towards a solution. You know, like if you didn't know that American healthcare was super messed up before COVID-19, I don't really know how much of a difference it makes, especially because the impacts are so disparate. You know, like people like us, like, you know, work from home jobs, like didn't lose a job in the pandemic, like not really at super high risk of getting sick. You know, so many people in my kind of like class cohort, whatever, are buying fucking houses right now. You know, they're buying houses because they have more money now than they had before. And that gap, you know, the fact that things are getting so much worse for people at the bottom and things are staying the same or getting better for people at the top, it's just not going to translate into any kind of, you know, like without some kind of mass mobilization of people at the bottom, which is obviously not happening, I can't see any kind of like progress on the horizon, basically. Sorry to be a doomer about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, as one of my final questions, like, what do?
I know. I truly don't. I struggle with what do all the time. You know, especially in the last year, you know, especially before I quit my job, like feeling just useless, just being like another fucking op-ed writer and, you know, like writing takes and, you know, just feeling like super miserable about everything and also feeling useless. It's hard to know what do. You know, and I am not an activist or an organizer in any way. And so, you know, I think that A allows me to be more of a doomer about it than people who are, but also means I don't really, I'm the least qualified to answer those questions. But for me, you know, donating money to or getting involved in, if you can't afford to donate money to mutual aid organizations and other things like that, you know, I mean, I think, you know, if you have the resources, like taking some of that stimmy check that we're all going to get, that generous $600 and, you know, just like donating it straight to a food bank is like, in terms of your individual personal response to the world, is like as pretty much as good as we can get for now. But, you know, like I said, I leave it up to organizers and activists to direct people to, you know, the best use of their like energies in those terms. I'm too sad to know the answer, basically.
You can at least feel better than me, because yeah, 2020 has really brought into light like how useless I am.
I
sit at home and I write like articles about like TV shows. I'm entirely useless to the universe as it is. Yeah. So the best thing I can do is occasionally like donate money and help out and help old ladies across the street.
Yeah, but I mean that's the thing, is like, you know, most of us aren't going to be the thing that makes the difference. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean that everyone should stop trying. Like, everyone should absolutely try as hard as we can. And I should try much harder to have more impact and stuff. And I'm hoping that Sick Note will allow me to have more impact than writing posts do. You know, part of the reason that I made the leap, you know, and quit my job was because, like I said, I was feeling useless. And I feel like, you know, if I can at least, you know, transmit people's stories, you know, make a record of the stuff that's happening, that is maybe, you know, I don't think it's going to get a single payer, but I'll feel more useful and, you know, in a selfish way, that's good for me.
I think we should all use our selfish feelings of like inadequacy to push us to do better. And
absolutely,
I hope that will be the message, is do something and do better, and
yes,
subscribe to Sick Note. And it'll inspire
you. Yeah, this is
a
long way of saying if you want to feel like you're doing something, you should absolutely subscribe to Sick.
No, but I do think it's a really valuable thing to have those stories out there and to be able to keep tabs on the stories and the news of what's going on, and hopefully we can all in our small way sort of find a way to make things a little bit more bearable and find a way through to single payer at some point.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, I also just want to say, like, you know, for people listening, if you have a healthcare story, if you, you know, and define broadly, you know, like maybe you have like a shitty job that makes your back hurt or something, you know, like just get at me. You know, sicknote.co is the website, and sicknotenewsletter@gmail.com. You can email me there and send me your stories, and I'd love to talk to you about it.
Yeah. And we'll have all the links in the description. Final question. Will subscribers get pictures of Digby?
That, you know, they actually will. So
yes!
the way it's gonna work is the first couple months everything is free and out from behind the paywall. You know, no paywall content for the first couple months, but eventually I have to put the paywall up because, you know, you gotta eat. And in my Friday roundups of the news, that's where I'm gonna put my Digby pics, my personal little bits and bobs, recipes I've made, you know, videos I like, things like that. And that's where the Digby content's going to go. Also, when you subscribe, the email that you get when you subscribe has a picture of Digby in it, and it's a really good one. So
yes,
that's an incentive.
I think I don't know if you saw it, but I think you at one point posted on Twitter asking for like suggestions, and I think I put like Digby in like a doctor's outfit or next to a cardboard box that's shaped like a hospital.
That's what I should have done for the logo, honestly.
I'm very easily amused.
Yeah.
Right, so I think that is our time up, but thank you very much, Libby Watson. You can find information about Sick Note and about Libby's work in the description. Please follow her, please subscribe to Current Affairs. And thank you very much, Libby, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me anytime.